listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host for the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very special friend of mine, and we go way back to our USC days. He also happens to be the guitarist for Lady A and a very accomplished jazz musician and amazing guitarist. Please welcome Jason Slim Gamble. How are you, Jason?
I'm good, man. Great to see you. Been a minute.
Been a long time. You know what? It's like, I know you go by Slim, but I've always known you as Jason.
I mean, you were there before the Slim ever happened.
Right. You know what? You and I have a cool connection. One, we both have balls signed by the great Les Paul.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, got them signed in the same place too, didn't we?
Yep. I think I got it. I think I was. I told you I took a trip to New York and I met him at the Iridium, and you were like, I'm going to New York in like a week. And I said, dude, good. You got to go to the Iridium, bring your Les Paul.
Drag your Les Paul across the country.
Right. That's right. And then I remember what he wrote. He said, like, keep banging on this thing, Les Paul.
Keep beating on this thing. Yeah.
On this thing. That's right. I remember you were like, write something dirty. Give me something filthy. And he was like, oh. Did you see him play that night as well?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Saw the show I saw the show one other time after that too. And,
what a legend.
He was always just it's like he's like your dirty uncle telling the jokes, man.
Very true. Do you bring that guitar out on the road? Probably not.
No, that doesn't go. I have a different gold top that like lives out on the road at this point, but no, this one it's right there.
That's awesome.
Since then, you know, that there's another autograph on there.
Who's this?
Gonna read it. But that's Slash signed it.
Oh, that's awesome.
It says to Jason, R and F and R Slash.
That is awesome. Where did you meet him?
So that was at a club right there in Beverly Hills called the Backstage.
Yep. I remember.
You remember, I don't know if it's still there or not, but Ian Copeland owned it. Yeah. I went there. This dude just dragged me there one night. Like, I mean, really long story, but found myself there and Slash is just hanging out holding court. And it was funny because he looked at it. He's standing there with a Sharpie and he's looking at it going like, you sure you want me to sign this? Because Les Paul had signed it already, right? And no one quite remembers this, but in 2000, Slash was not like cool.
Right.
Like there was that era between when he was like the guy
right.
and now when he's the guy again. And yeah. He's like, you know, he's an icon. But there was that brief moment in the early 2000s where it's like, no one wanted anything to do with like the rock music of the late 80s, early 90s.
Yes.
So he was just questioning himself. And I'm like, no side of it. You're Slash. There's no way around that.
Icon, no matter what. It's funny. I saw the Foo Fighters play for Dave Grohl's birthday concert.
Yeah.
And he came out and played with them. And I remember walking out to the parking lot and I like ducked out as soon as they finished and everybody's crossing the street and Slash pulls up in like this huge, it looked like a huge SUV. It was like an Escalade or something like that. And nobody noticed that Slash was in the car. And so I just lipped to him. I was like, you were so awesome. I just did that. I said, you were so awesome. And he was like, thanks, man. And all these people are crossing the street, not realizing that Slash is sitting in the car. And I'm like, you just saw him play. Like, how do you not know that he's sitting in the car?
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. I was like, but I didn't want to be like, oh, there's Slash or anything like that and bring attention. But
right.
That's amazing. I want to talk a little bit like you know, I saw that you changed majors a couple times in your bio at USC. Tell me what. So I know you started as studio guitar, right? Or did you?
No, I started as recording arts.
Oh my God. Really?
Thing. Yeah. And in fact, I finished as recording arts too, because after changing majors, I think five or six times, and I was there for 5.5 years.
Right.
And finally I realized, like, I really needed to finish something. Right. So that was what I had the most credits in. And I finished my recording arts degree with an American history minor, which was,
wow,
had been one of my stop offs in terms of my majors. Like I went through studio jazz guitar. I was like a double major for a minute. I did anthropology. I did political science. I did history.
Wow.
There was something called like social sciences with a history emphasis or something like that. And then kind of got back to where I started, because I just need to graduate at this point.
Well, did you kind of like, were you afraid of just kind of going full on into the music thing, or were you kind of like, I should do something that has a little bit more academia to it, or was it just like, this is what I like, I want to just explore all the things that I'm doing?
I think there was a certain amount of just me being kind of like institutionalized. Like I started taking some upper division history courses and got into the academic side of college, pretty deep into that. And I did the studio jazz guitar major for a minute, and I didn't really excel. And I was also holding down the recording arts major. No, I failed your pre-recital.
What?
Like I did the pre-recital, and they're kind of like, yeah, you're not ready to do a recital. And I'm like, and at this point, I was coming up on my fifth year at USC, which, you know, cha-ching.
Right, right.
And so I was just like, I don't got time to, like, spend another year trying to do my junior year recital.
I want to ask about this, because, like, you are a fantastic guitarist.
Well, thanks.
Because it was, like, they were pushing a certain style. Was it jazz? Like, was it reading? Was it a certain thing that they were just, like, you weren't ready for? Because you can play. You've always been able to play.
You know, I think it was, like, the proper jazz side of it. And it's one of those things, like, to this day, like, I you know, they weren't wrong in terms of me being able to play jazz like jazz.
Right.
And to this day, like, I wish that I had actually paid attention to Frank Potenza and Joe DiOrio and Pat Suna and Pat Kelly, who were showing me this stuff.
Right.
And I just wasn't happy, because I was, like, into funk bands and into, like, classic rock and R&B and, like, doing that stuff. And so I was just like, man, I'm never going to play straight ahead. Like, I look over on my table here, and like, there's all these jazz standards that I play like every chance I get. But like, I wish I had gone down that road a little bit more, but the fact is I didn't. And so I probably wasn't qualified to earn that degree.
you were definitely qualified. I think the one thing that I've heard from a lot of people is like, the studio guitar department was kind of like trying to churn out a lot of jazz guitarists, and because they love jazz guitar, which is great, but it's like, it didn't set up a lot of guitarists for like studio work in the same way that they probably could have if it was a strictly studio guitar set, the major, you know what I mean? So
it was, there was a fair amount of like, we learned a lot of Steely Dan, and there was that side of it and like the studio players. But in terms of like the recitals and the academic portion of it,
right,
it was very much jazz. And I wish I had kind of paid attention more. And it's funny, because I brought this up to a buddy of mine, this bass player in Chicago. I was complaining about, it's like all these schools, like they emphasize like, you know, bop lines and like straight ahead and standards and stuff. And he says, well, you know, they have to have something to make it a major.
Right.
Like I can't just major in the Allman Brothers.
Why not?
Because so I was like, well, I mean, you could, but like, am I going to give USC $200,000 to teach me to play the Allman Brothers? No, I'm going to figure that out on my own. So like, he was like, they have to teach you something. And I'm going, it's a valid point. Like in terms of like academic learning, you know, a lot of music majors are classical and there's an academic aspect of that. And jazz is the same way. So it's like, this is something concrete. There's actually a beginning, a middle, and an end to how we structure this, as opposed to all like the pop stuff that you and I have learned.
Right.
It's like, there's not really a formula for how you learn that.
But it's also like, you know, it's the type of thing I also worry that, let's say a Miles Davis comes to a music school, he's not going to learn and gravitate towards how they're teaching all of this stuff. That's what worries me. It's like you can't keep any creative mind in a box when there are possibilities to be explored that you have to allow the student or the artist that's going to be the artist to just kind of like let loose and kind of, you know, you have to, there has to be a basis and then there has to be a point where it's like, okay, run free with this. And yeah. I think that's a big problem. I went through the same thing with the classical department. I was like, oh my God, this is so crazy. And now they've got like the pop music program, which I think is better, but still, and I was curious because like, I was kind of fascinated reading your bio. I was like, man, I didn't know that you kind of like switched around and had any kind of gripe with any of the music school process. You know what I mean? Because I did. And I felt like I was alone when I was going through that.
No, you certainly weren't. I mean, there were a lot of people that managed to do it by the letter and really kind of fit into that world. But I mean, there were a lot that I think a lot of people ended up like getting the music industry major or kind of going into, you know, pop music where it was something that was a little bit less structured and a little bit more open to interpretation. And maybe that's, I think, you know, that's probably the other reason I finished with a recording major. Cause I mean, I got a recording degree. Like I learned how to align tape machines.
Right.
Well, okay. So like I got a degree in Sanskrit, right? Like my senior year, we got our first Pro Tool rig. It was like, I finished with that just to finish something. And because there was like maybe some structure that I was like, okay, I just need to do this and this and this, and I'll be done. But yeah, in terms of spreading my wings, I took advantage of the college experience and like, I took classes in everything and was super into it. Even to the point where like after college, you know, I don't know if you knew this, but like I went to graduate school at UCLA.
I did not know this.
For American history.
Wow.
And I was on, you know, PhD track American history student. And that didn't last that long because my band signed a record deal. And so I went on leave of absence from grad school and never quite went back. But I was, when I said I was institutionalized, I was really like just so into the world of academia. Like I just had this crazy thirst for knowledge. And also probably the musician's resistance to going into the outside world and trying to like, you know, survive. So I was like, well, college is like a, you know, it's scary, but it's kind of a safe space at some point.
And what's good is like you meet so many creative minds and you kind of like draw on that. I think the one thing that college was missing for me was collaborating with musicians like yourselves. Like that only happened if it was like we were hanging out at your apartment or I was hanging with musicians that I was like living next to. It just wasn't a collaborative experience. And I think that's the one thing that was missing from it. I have two questions. Did you study with Joe DiOrio? And what was the best thing you learned from him? Because he was kind of like a shaman for me. I never took lessons from him, but we would talk music all the time in between him teaching classes and me having to do a class. Mm-hmm. And he was in that little lounge. So what was the best thing that you learned from him? I'm just curious because I think he was kind of a guru and it's a shame that he's no longer around, you know?
Yeah. Well, same boat. I never actually got the chance to study with him. And he would like, you know, sit in on something like the trios class. He would show up and like, you know, impart wisdom on everybody. And, you know, same thing. I had some conversations with him, but no, I unfortunately didn't really get to spend, I didn't get as much out of him as I wish I could have. Much like all the other professors there, but yeah, Joe DiOrio was a different kind of player, man. I mean, he talk about a guy that like blazed his own trail. I mean, the way that he played guitar is untouchable. Like he really had a thing, and it's unfortunate he doesn't necessarily get regarded in the same way as Kenny Burrell or Joe Pass or any one of, you know, Wes, like all of those great jazz guitar players. It's like Joe DiOrio. He was absolutely up there and really like one of the more identifiable styles of post-bop players out there ever.
And you know what? Like, I'm sure you knew this, but he was actually one of the last people. I think he was the last person to play Wes Montgomery's guitar.
Because that was all right.
They did a concert together and they were like up late jamming, like, and so he was like, they were swapping guitars, and then I think Wes died like within 2 weeks after that. Like, wow. and the two were a kind of like thing, and it's like he was one of the last people to play on Wes's guitar. So I'm like, he was a legend just from that for me. And I would always just ask him about concepts and like his whole outlook on music. And it was so different than every professor that I ever met there. So, and I never even got to study with him. I only just got to have these conversations. So
I mean, you get a lot out of that though.
Yes. Yes. And my second question is, if you were learning recording techniques on tape, did you ever utilize them, or has it all been digital for the most part? Not at all? Wow.
Not even once, because, you know, by the time I got out of college, I had no interest in being a recording engineer.
Right.
Like, I didn't go intern. A good buddy of mine, you probably knew Steve Kaplan.
Yes.
Yeah. He was my roommate, a really good friend, and he's been enormously successful as an engineer. But he was like in college, he was recording and he was like engineering live music. He was second engineer to Chris Lord Alge for years. Wow. Like, he was digging in because he was going to be a great engineer. And like he ended up being a great successful. I mean, he's engineered everything for Bear McCreary and just all of this. I mean, he's one of the guys out there. Right. But I was never that. Like, I kind of figured out early on, I was like, I don't really want to do this. At the end of the day, I just came to LA and to USC because I wanted to play guitar.
Right. You know? Right.
The engineering degree was a convenient excuse to tell my parents, like, because it's like, oh, it's an engineering degree, practical job I could get, right. Which of course is like laughable, because it's like, yeah, you can make coffee in a studio with your engineering degree. Like, they don't care.
Right.
But it was an excuse to get to LA. So like, I guess at the end of the day, I never actually wanted to be a recording engineer. So short answer to your question, no, I don't know how to align a tape machine. I never did that for a living. Everything I know about recording at this point was from just getting Pro Tools, yeah, and sitting down and getting, you know, Superior Drummer, programming, recording, and just messing around with stuff. And then, you know, just the editing process that we can do in the box at this point. It's just something like in the back of the bus, I just kind of sat there and just did, which, like a lot of people, you know, you can kind of get, you know, Logic or Pro Tools or whatever, and just, you just sit down and just mess with it. And now you get on YouTube and you look up tutorials. If you can't figure out how to do something, someone will show you.
Well, I asked too, it's because like I went through, I think about 3 records where I did them all on analog tape. And like there is a process that I really respect about it, because you have less choices. You cannot do unlimited tracks. That's like the one part. It's like you can't indulge in some of the things that you may want to. So you streamline what your arrangements are going to be.
At some point, you got to get it right.
Yeah, you got to get it right. And also the analog mixing I find fascinating, because it's like you're not going to get the same mix back to back unless there's heavy automation. And that sometimes is going to take more time than just doing another mix. So like, I like that part of the process, but then coming back to digital, it's like, oh my God, this is so convenient. Why do people make records on analog tape when it's just so easy on digital? But I like both, and I wanted to know both just to understand all sides of the coin.
For sure.
Let's talk about you getting out of school. How did you link up? You linked up with Joe Firstman. You got signed to Atlantic, right? Isn't that?
Yeah.
And then tell me what that process was like. Were you touring? Were you playing festivals? Were you doing opening slots? Like, tell me where you were and how long that was going on.
Man, that, like, we went into the studio as a band and recorded a bunch of stuff. And it was like, I can't prove this, but I feel like there was a period of time after John Mayer showed up on the scene where suddenly there were no bands anymore.
Right, right.
So the band Firstman, which this should have been kind of, you know, a red flag, the band was called Firstman.
Right.
Firstman became Joe Firstman.
Right, right.
So, and honestly, his first record, The War of Women, probably 75% of that record is our band.
Right.
So it was sides that we cut for Atlantic as a band, but it became Joe Firstman. And again, I think just in the wake of the singer-songwriter movement, where, you know, historic, as a historian, I could look back on this and say, like, I feel like there was actually before John Mayer and after John Mayer, because like really there were before that, there were a lot of bands. Look, yeah, at the 90s, you know, look at the Matchbox 20s and the Better Than Ezra's and the Vertical Horizons and I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And then look after that, and it's all some guy's name.
Yep. It became songwriter heavy.
And you know, great music, great artists,
yep.
But bands were no longer as consequential as they were.
Were you getting that kind of experience from the label? Were they kind of like, you know, shortening you guys on budgets or like not promoting as much? Were you kind of going through some of that other side of the record label stuff, or were you just not really dealing with that? Just creative.
We were kind of like up against it. Like our band was a very like Black Crowes meets Led Zeppelin kind of like Southern rock band.
Right.
Right. And so again, in the wake of stuff sort of simmering down in terms of rock bands and becoming more acoustic singer songwriter vibes, we weren't really generating what they were after. So it was like the classic thing of like, oh, I don't hear a single, like I don't hear anything for the radio right now. And so one thing led to another, and I can't leave this out of the story. Me and Joe did not get along.
Oh, okay.
There was friction there. There was friction around the, I don't want to like pot all this off on like the A&R guys, because like we had issues to begin with, like really from jump. I kind of ended up in that band. Like a good buddy of mine, Will Fogle, started that band with Joe.
Well, yeah.
They had a big falling out. So I think I kind of went into it. I can look back on this now and say I definitely went into it with like the wrong attitude. You know, I went into it thinking like, oh man, he needs me, like he's my buddy, like okay. And, you know, the guy who's, you know, on the dark side of his 40s now, I look back on this like, good God, man, like I was as much, he was an asshole. I was an asshole.
No,
you know, what could you do? So it's like there was a lot of that between friction and the band. What's that?
I said, you've never been an asshole. I can't believe that.
So. Oh, buddy. When I look back on some of the things that I said in those heated conversations, it's like, oh my goodness. I despise myself at that point in life. And we're also all hammered at all times.
Right.
We were all, you know, 22 years old on the streets of Hollywood. So right. What can you do? Live and learn.
Between
all those factors, that whole thing fell to pieces. The band got dropped. Joe got re-signed. And we all, you know, 23 years old, we thought that our entire worlds had come to a screeching halt. And I'm like, I'm never going to make it in the music industry. My life is over. But then, you know, we move on and get into other stuff.
Well, you also Ellie, that was the last time I think I saw you play live. What's so interesting is I saw you. No, it was with Josh Kelly.
So oh, yeah. Okay, sure.
Linked up with Josh Kelly, and you guys were playing. I want to say you were playing at the Roxy, and you brought out Charles Kelly. And I was like, man, this guy, Charles Kelly, can sing his ass off. And I want to say he was playing keys, too. He sat in on keys. And
Charles was not playing keys.
Okay, so he was just singing then.
Just standing there singing. Yep.
And I remember you guys did like a soul tune or something. It was like, and it was just awesome. I was like, yeah. So you were playing with Josh Kelly, and then you linked up with Charles, and then now you're in a band with him. What was that transition like? That had to be a little bit of a like a seesaw situation.
I mean, so that it's funny because Charles, I mean, still tells this story on the stage if we're doing like a little acoustic show or something like that. That, you know, Charles came out that show you're talking about. It was a place called Club Lingerie.
Yeah, that's right.
You remember that spot? Yeah, and it was a 9/11 show. Like I think 2 years after 9/11, so I think it was probably three or 4 years. So it was like 2004-ish.
Yep.
And I was playing with Josh, and on the bill also was Joe Firstman and Tony Luca. And Charles had just graduated from college, and he came out, and you know, I was hanging with Josh, of course, and Josh is like, says, man, you got to meet my brother. He's a great singer. He's great with melodies. You guys should like write some songs and stuff. And I meet Charles, and Charles had just gotten out of the University of Georgia. And it's, you know, not to be judgy, but he's the first one to tell you this. He's just a 6'7" frat boy and looking like it. And we're all like Hollywooded out and just, you know, you won't even go to the grocery store without wearing show clothes. Right.
So
it was kind of like, huh, okay, this guy's a brilliant musician, sure. But I, you know, to your point earlier, I tend to get along with people, you know, I tend to be friendly to people. And so like me and Charles hit it off, and it was like, we did the sound check at Club Lingerie, and everyone just like dispersed. Everyone kind of blew off Charles because he's just like sitting over there at the table, just soaking it in. And like everyone took off after sound check. And I will never forget this because quite frankly, it might have affected the rest of my life. Like I went up, I'm like, hey man, what do you do? Like, do you want to go over to Baja Fresh and get a burrito? And we went over there, got a burrito, hung out. And like Charles, still to this day, he says, yeah, I was in Hollywood. And like Slim was the only one to be nice to me.
Wow.
And I'm like, good Lord. Like, man, what an important moment.
But you know what? That's a testament to your character. That's
It's Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse, man. Be nice.
Yes, be nice. You know what? Like when I was learning guitar, I don't think you remember this. I remember talking to you. I'm like, man, I want you to teach me some funk chords.
I remember that.
And I went over to your place, and you were showing me the rhythm guitars for 1999 by Prince.
Oh, yeah.
Remember you just showing me, like, these are the voicings. And I was like, just the fact that you did that was so big for me because it was like, yeah, I wasn't anybody. I was just learning and, like, you didn't have to waste your time with somebody that was just learning when you were already playing.
I was 1 year past you in school. No, but you upperclassmen.
So it was just like, that's a testament to your character. That's, you know, like, I've always seen you as that kind of like, you know, a sincere and sweet cat that just was always down to play and help creators create. So it makes sense that you guys linked up. In your bio, it said there was a Hollywood record executive that linked you to Josh. Do you talk to that person? Was that person a mentor for you or no?
So, gosh, actually, I should reach out to him at some point, actually. A guy named Eric Klinger. Okay, so he was at, that's what it was. So when Firstman, the band, was showcasing for labels, Eric Klinger had seen us play. He was basically like an intern-ish, like maybe a step above an intern at Warner. And he got an A&R guy by the name of Tim Devine to come and see us. And because Tim Devine came and saw us, all these other record labels kind of swarmed. Okay. Right. So, and Klinger made that happen because he was just, I assume still is, just passionate music guy, like passionate music dude always, right? And so he essentially like started that flood going that got Firstman signed. Fast forward, he ends up getting a job as an A&R guy for Hollywood Records. He signed Josh Kelly. So Josh Kelly did his first record. He went out on tour, did this and that. When it came time to do his second record, Klinger had always wanted to get me involved with Josh. On the first record, he did his record with John Alasia, and John Alasia like had his way of doing things. Alasia was like massive at the time. I think he'd done Room for Squares, right?
He's actually like, a friend of mine. He's been on this show.
Oh, okay. So you know, I mean, so his resume, especially like right then in the early 2000s, like
yeah, he right, broke Jason Mraz, he broke Josh, he broke John Mayer.
Like, yeah. So he it was one of those things. They did Josh's first record. It was like, do whatever you want to do, John Alasia, because you're the guy, right? And he made a great record. Come time for LP2, Klinger's like, he says, man, I always wanted to have you involved. So like, come in with some of the guys from that band, but we're going to put a bunch of us that were like playing around Hollywood together. We were doing this jazz night and we were, you know, a bunch of buddies that were doing stuff. So we worked on Josh's second record, Almost Honest, with Matt Wallace, who they got Matt, like Matt was a big deal at the time. Like he had just done Songs for Jane, you know, the first Maroon 5 record.
That's right, killer record.
And so he got Matt Wallace and Matt was like completely just open book. He's like, sure, yeah, get your buddies to come play. So it ended up being like, I mean, that band was myself, Dave Yaden. Did you ever know Dave? He played with Firstman.
He was on the show about a month ago, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you crossed paths with Dave, of course. So Dave Yaden, Mike Miley, who has a band called Rival Sons now.
I don't know, Mike.
Donald Barrett.
Yeah, Donald so Barrett.
Donald played on Almost Honest. And Ben Peeler, the ridiculous, you know, multi-instrumentalist. He's played with everybody. And Darwin Johnson played bass. And then there were a couple other odds and ends, like, I can't remember the name of the guitar player from the Wallflowers came in and played. And it was a lot of this awesome. And that. We recorded at Sound City. And so it was just this killer vibe. Like we cut his record and then, you know, came time to tour and he brought me out on tour. And that was the same time that Charles came out. Charles kind of came out on the bus just to hang out. Like he wow. was, he was supposed to be working and doing things. But I mean, basically we came out, you know, got drunk and, you know, looked just partied.
That's awesome.
So that was kind of like the beginning of the evolution. And then, you know, to fast forward, like Josh had a house in Nashville with a studio in it. All of us in our circle of singer songwriter guys and just buddies like would crash there when we were in Nashville. Charles and Dave Haywood ended up moving in there just to come to Nashville and like try to be songwriters.
Right.
And it was just one day I was on the phone with Charles because I had been back and forth quite a bit. And he was just like, he says, man, we got this band. We got this trio together. It's like, you gotta come out to Nashville and like, you know, hang out. And like, we need a guitar player to play these showcases with us. We'll write songs. We'll live at my brother's house, which is a 5,000 square foot brand new house in Franklin with a studio. And, you know, he says, yeah, just come out. And I've obviously, having been in Hollywood for as long as I was, like, oh, we have label interest is just kind of like, whatever. But I was like, at one of those low points in LA where I had just come off tour. And I was just kind of had nothing in particular to do.
Right.
So I was like, sure, man, I'll drive to Nashville. So I threw my gear in the truck and Dave Yaden hopped in with me. We drove to Nashville and, you know, he talked me into, he's like, drive to Nashville. Don't fly. He says, don't just come and hang out and see what happens. And, you know,
wow.
I guess the rest is history. That was, you know, I got to Nashville on Hillary Scott's 21st birthday and went directly to the Tin Roof South for her birthday party. That was April 1st, 2007. And then July 1st, 2007, like I was in Oakland's first trip. And it was, which also, I mean, the crazy thing I always think about this, July 1st, 2007 was my 30th birthday. So it was like this crazy, like, boom, transition point.
Right. And did you know, when you started playing with them, were you like, this has something? Was it like an electric kind of, you know, that there's always something with a first rehearsal or a first gig where you're all kind of like looking at each other like there's something here. Like, did you have that moment or was it just like, this just feels like an old t-shirt that just feels comfortable?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is that the first showcase I played with them, I was like utility guy. I had been learning to play like pedal steel and lap steel and mandolin and banjo. And so they had a guitar player. And I was covering all the utility duties and some more electric guitar. So to be perfectly honest, I saw how people responded to it. And I was like, this is obviously good stuff. And I dug the music. But I was so busy trying to keep my freaking head above water with all these instrument changes of instruments that I had no business playing. Especially when I got to Nashville, I'm kind of like, oh, my God, like that's what pedal steel is supposed to sound like.
Right.
So I was like so busy just trying to figure it all out that I wasn't even conscious of that. But the first showcase we did, they packed out Third and Lindsley. People are losing their damn minds. And then like it was like just brawl between labels to get them on. Wow. The labels. I mean, it was like because at the time, like that thing, you know, the vocal trio with two lead singers, kind of the Fleetwood Mac vibe, especially right. In Nashville, they're just like, what is this?
Right. Right.
And it was just, you know, it blew up again. It was a really, really busy few years after that.
And I remember texting you, I took my mom to the Grammys the first year I was a Recording Academy member and you guys played and you played Need You Now. Yeah. And I remember texting you like, yo, were you in, I'm like, I know that was you. Cause
lurking in the shadows back there.
I could just tell it was because you just have a look. You know what I mean? It's like I could see you in a crowd of 1,000 people and be like, there's Jason. You know what I mean? And it's so, and you were like, yeah, that was me. I was there. I'm like, this is crazy. That's so awesome. I was there and it sounded amazing. And now you've toured the world. You've done all these crazy things and you have a jazz record out, which is awesome.
Jazz adjacent.
No, I mean, let's call it what it is. It's just cool jazz. It's cool jazz. Let's call
I'll take it.
What made you come back after all of, you know, you've been playing major festivals, you've done all these great albums, you've toured with this band for almost 2 decades, right? Just about 15.
Yeah, it's 18 and a half years now, so almost 2 decades.
So what made you come back to wanting to put a jazz record out? Were you riding along like this whole journey and just kind of like putting things like off to the side in a hard drive somewhere, or like did it all just come out all at once?
man, it's like I had spent a good chunk of time in Nashville when I first got here, like just writing country songs and doing that stuff. But, you know, obviously my background is in jazz sort of, and, you know, jam bands and stuff like that. And really, I got about 10 years in to Lady A. You know, we'd been busy, we'd been on the road, but I kind of suddenly became aware of, I think I saw like a video of my old band Deep Fried, of me and Davey Aiden, like trading off and just like.
Somewhere. I have that CD, Deep Fried. Really?
Nice. I have a copy somewhere too. I try to avoid it, but yeah, I think I saw a video of just like the chops and like the improvisational ability and like, I find it hard to say this without sounding like a just douche, but like when you're a backing musician, you're playing someone else's music, you're serving someone else's songs. And in pop country, there's a lot of G chords involved.
Yep.
And there's a lot of like stuff where it's like, I kind of discovered, I became aware of the fact that like my sort of chops, my skills had kind of gone downhill in a sense, because I just wasn't playing that stuff. Yeah, right. I wasn't playing like that. I wasn't like playing hard. I wasn't improvising. I wasn't jamming with people. And I kind of just, I was getting to the point, you know, we're doing 150, 200 shows a year for years. And so it's a lot of playing, but I was kind of like, gosh, like I need some sort of creative outlet besides trying to like write country songs, which was not a creative outlet.
And First of all, I love that you listen to that instinct, because a lot of players play that G chord, and I love that you, I was so thrilled when I saw that, because, and you know this, we both know a ton of musicians that they're in bands, they're touring, and they don't have time to release a record, or they don't put the time into it, and the fact that you like put the time into it, it comes back to like your passion for music, and wanting to create and wanting to get those chops back to where it was. So I'm so happy you listened to that instinct, because you should be doing that stuff all the time. Yeah. You should be making records all the time, because you have facility, you have a breadth of knowledge that you should document. You know what I mean? And it's like, totally. That's what it is. It's like, if you didn't do this, the world wouldn't know. And it's like, that's what's great about you making records and putting it out there. And speaking of which, let's play something. What do you want to play us first?
What did I say? Oh, you know what? Like the newest track that just came out that I kind of need to get promoting a little bit more is called Lay It Down. I'm trying to play the old algorithm game like everyone else and just drop a track like every 6 weeks.
Yep.
So the latest one, like I did a little quickie video with a buddy of mine that I've been doing little videos for every tune. And yeah, it's called Lay It Down. It's just a fun little jam, and the video looks really cool. We spent about 30 minutes making it. It turned out great.
Let's play it. Here's Lay It Down by Jason Slim Gamble.
Yeah. Thank you.
Dude, first of all, it's terrific.
Thanks, man.
It is terrific. Second of all, I love that you put real drums because, my God, it drives me crazy when you hear these amazing jazz guitarists and they have like these soft kind of drums playing, and it just drives me bonkers. But I love that you did like an old school feel with new school kind of flair and the sound. It's like funky. It's like New Orleans-ish. It's like Memphis-y, but it's also a lot of you. Tell me kind of how you came up with the sound.
So that was the first time that I've gone into the studio with a band in quite some time, like really since before COVID, since my first record. Because like COVID, you know, everyone had a rig, but during COVID, we all like kind of really learned how to use them because it was just necessary. Like it was the only way to cut records. And so everything I did for really, two full albums worth of stuff was, you know, I would start with like a basic track, and then I would send it out to a buddy to play drums on, and send it out to a buddy to play bass on and keys. And so it was all like a, you know, not a hodgepodge, but they would just send me a pile of tracks, and then I would just sort of edit the whole thing together.
Right.
And you know, you can get stuff feeling pretty good like that. You can get really great sounds that way. But that thing that's missing, you as, you know, a guy that fronts a band that jams, that stretches out,
like
the quality that gets lost is just those little things that sort of take place.
Yep.
And they don't take place when one part is like, oh, this part's completely done. This part can't react to this part that's being overdubbed.
Yep.
Those little tiny reactions that you don't even know are there, but it's just a thing. And so in this case, like I piggybacked on, like I had some clients, like I do just put together sessions in Nashville for individual clients that might have like a song or two that they want to get a great master take on, but they can't afford to, like, they don't want to book a whole day at the studio. So it's kind of like, okay, get a bunch of clients together and, you know, book out Sound Emporium Room 2, get some world-class musicians. We cut your tunes. And then I'm kind of like, oh, hey guys, while we're here, can you do a couple of mine?
That's awesome. That's smart.
So it's like, it's an economical way for everybody. But in my case, it's kind of like, hey, like I'm booking this day. Everyone's going to get paid, you know, solidly. Everyone's going to get some great tracks out of it. But, you know, I get to like spend the last few hours of the day cutting my own tunes. And it's buddies of mine. They're great players. And so we get to go in and get that live band effect that I'd forgotten about it, because I'd been making records again in the box remotely for so long that I didn't feel like I was missing it. And then I got in and like cut tracks with the guys, and I'm just like, oh geez. And also the drum sounds, we're in Sound Emporium Room B. Like it's a legendary room. So go figure, the drums are ridiculous.
You have to promise me that you'll always make records, because man, that sounded like fire. And it's like,
thanks, man.
It's like whenever I'm in a studio with my band or any other band, it's like I always look for moments. Like you want those moments where you're interacting, instruments are interacting with each other, and you have moments through this whole track where it's just like ping-ponging back and forth with your guitar solo, with drums, with bass. I mean, it's just, you have the horn hits. It just sounds like a band that's just doing things together and making it exciting. And there's nothing better when a band plays for one another. That's what it sounds like. You know what I mean? You capture it. It's one of the hardest things to do. So, man, fantastic track.
Thanks, man.
I want to get to all of them. So let's play another one. What do you want to play next?
I think I see, like light this candle. This one's a little bit different. This was somehow in some alternate freaking universe. Like I had a big hit on Smooth Jazz Radio, and it also has live drums on it, but a producer named Adam Hawley, who's a USC guy actually, he did the track and it did really well. It kind of like, it got me some really good festival bookings, and it's one of those formats I never thought I would find myself in, and it's called Light This Candle, and there you go.
That's awesome. Real quick, I wanted to ask you about your guitar that you're playing. It looks like an ES. SV35. I know it's an Ibanez. Is it chambered like an ES35?
It's not a block. That's actually the Eric Krasno model.
Oh,
they don't make anymore, I guess. But that's the Japanese version of the Eric Krasno model, which is hanging right behind me. And it's like, I've got a handful of 335s, and that one has kind of become the favorite.
I love it.
Yeah.
We have the guitars that we just gravitate towards.
So one of those things, man.
Well, let's play it. This one's called Light My Candle.
I Light This Candle.
Here's Light This Candle.
Yes, sir.
Slamming, dude. A lot of costume changes.
Yep.
You're playing like a sewer. It looks like a sewer jazz master. Is that what you're playing?
Yeah, there's two different jazz masters and a Strat.
Right, and they're all sewers, or they are.
Yeah.
Oh man, I love those cars. They just make.
It's great stuff, man. Like really, really. I never thought that I'd be like a boutique guitar guy, but I mean, they play themselves.
I love all great guitars because they're just made well for a reason, you know? So I wanted to ask a guitar question. How did you know which guitar that would that you'd use to kind of like create your voice for this record? Or did you kind of grab all of them? But you know what I mean? Like there's certain songs that make you know, like, oh, I should use this guitar. Like, how did you gravitate towards a certain guitar for it to be the voice on a track?
It's kind of with each different tune. There's generally a process of going through a few different guitars and a few different just general setups before I kind of find it, because it's sort of what sits with everything else the best. A lot of time I'll start out with one thing, but then once the whole band is on there and it's kind of finding a blend, I'm kind of like, it just doesn't like sit right. But for that kind of stuff, honestly, the secret weapon for the smooth jazz type sounds has been the PRS McCarty. Just dead stock. Like that's kind of ended up being like, it sort of sits in just the right spot. But other ones, like I've used the Krasno quite a bit. Some of my early singles, I was using my gold top, my Les Paul.
That's awesome.
And then those other 335s have made some appearances. I've actually, like, as far as recording Strat stuff, a PRS, the John Mayer, the what's it called, the Silver Sky.
My favorite guitar. I've been playing it so much. It's just, do you have a maple neck or a rosewood? Do you have
maple?
Yeah, so I have the rosewood, and I'm thinking about getting a maple because I love maple too. But
it's spanky. I mean, it's got that. I've come around to maple necks in recent years. Like I still have way more rosewood necks than maple, but like I've got the maple thing. I never thought the neck would make that big of a difference in the tone, but in fact, it does.
Yeah, I have a kind of a good balance of. I have one Strat that's like a 66 custom shop that is a maple neck, and then I have a lot of rosewood necks, but I have a couple maple necked Strats and Tellies, and I just love them. They're just something about each of them, though. It's like, I was going to ask, do you have like a roasted pine Strat? Because I'm looking at like some of those now, because that's what the Fender custom shops, they come out with roasted pine. I'm like, I've never played a roasted pine guitar. What?
I have a custom built this builder in Tucson. I have a Telly that has, it's a roasted maple neck.
Okay.
But I haven't experienced roasted pine, huh? Like a pine body?
Yeah, no, it's just the neck. I think it's a roasted pine. The neck is roasted pine, and the body maybe also, it's either maple or pine. I think the body is maple, and just the neck is roasted pine.
I have no idea what that would sound like, but I mean, if they're doing it, it must sound cool.
Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine just bought one, so I was like, oh my God, I've never played a roasted pine.
Might as well give it a whirl.
I love the PRSs. I've got a custom 24. I've got a Silver Sky. But I'm sure you're like this. I'm constantly jumping from one guitar. I go back to the SC35, and I'm like, why am I not playing this? I play my Les Paul, and I'm like, why am I not playing this? I play my, you know, my Jazzmaster. I'm like, this should be on a record. So I'm constantly going back and forth. I'm sure you are too.
That's the process, man. But that's the fun thing. It's like getting to a point where like you have all those guitars that you could just grab and check out. Like that's pretty great. Because I mean, you know, we all experienced. I mean, for years, it's like, well, I have a guitar.
Yes. Yes.
And if something's wrong with it, I guess I can't play a gig.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you ever say, I've got enough guitars, I'm good?
I mean, I started saying that probably 10 years ago. Like I tell people this all the time. The first time they walk into this room, it's like, it's kind of overwhelming. Cause I mean, there's guitars freaking everywhere.
Right.
And like, I made an excuse for years, cause for a long time I was staying busy in Nashville. I was busy on the road. And so I was kind of like, okay, I need like a bunch of guitars on the road. I need to have a bunch of guitars in town for like cartage stuff. I need to have other guitars that are just handy at the house. So it was kind of like, okay, I was getting everything like in triplicate half the time, you know, I have like another one of these. But then at some point it went over the top where it's kind of like, there's no reason to have
it. Yes.
I've been on quite like a vintage acoustic tear the last few years.
That's awesome.
I've kind of like, I've really enjoyed playing acoustic guitar, like almost more than like I found grabbing an instrument and playing it and not having to dick around with anything else.
Yep.
has been, and you know, really great. You know, my first awesome acoustic was, still is, a Santa Cruz D from the early 90s. And then I got into some old stuff, and I'm just like, oh, like I picked up in a trade a 68 all Brazilian D35.
Oh, wow. That sounds awesome.
It's great, man. Like there's a solid pile of old acoustics now. And I've really become an acoustic guy the last 10 years or so, in addition to, you know, the pile of old amps and the pile of electric guitars. And
well, I would say you got to check out, there's a good all guitars, some of my favorite acoustic guitars, and I'm just about to buy a Rockbridge guitar. He was on the radio show too. And they're just well-made instruments. I mean, just very, very beautiful, beautifully made acoustic guitars. So, but let's play
the Rockbridge.
Rockbridge. It's
okay.
Dave Matthews uses Rockbridge.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
He uses now. And Goodall, I think Seal has a Goodall, but Abe Dirtner was the reason I got turned on to a Goodall, and it's one of my best guitars. It's made with Sinker Redwood, Indian Rosewood, Koa bindings. Yeah, it's a sick
guitar. I have not heard that name in a long time.
I know. Crazy, right? Last from the past.
You said that, I'm like, wait a second. I know that name.
What's the name of the last song? Let's play the last song.
Last song I just threw up just for fun because I like how the video turned out. It's called Here Come the Heroes, and I had this buddy who does animation do like a partially animated video, and it's like it features my entire family as superheroes. And and the same thing, Mike Miley from Rival Sons is playing drums, and Joe Ayoub is playing bass, Kenneth Crouch is playing keys. It's an all-star band,
one more time.
Here Come the Heroes. Perfect. I made it as sort of like a cartoon superhero theme song.
Here's Here Come the Heroes by Jason Slim Gamble. That was awesome. You got yourself animated, dude.
I haven't watched that in a minute. Yeah.
That was awesome. Very, very cool. What was the inspiration behind the song?
God, I'm trying to, that tune's like actually kind of, it's from quite a while ago. Like, how did I come up with that? Like, I can't remember. Like, I feel like the line, "Here come the heroes," like I maybe play ba ba da ba ba, and it's just like, here come the heroes. Like, that probably just came to my mind. I'm kind of like, what if it's just like, you know, and I think my kids were young at the time too. So it's kind of like, you know, we watch a lot of PJ Masks, and so I think it all kind of, you know, came together in that sense. And then I you know, just put in like the, you know, like kind of Batman samples and that kind of stuff. What's that?
It's the life imitating art.
Yeah, yeah. And then I can't remember where I met Trey, but Trey Bailey, this great artist and animator, like I met him at one of my shows, I think. And then when I went to, you know, I cut that tune and I was kind of like, I wonder if he can like do an animated thing. And doing a fully animated thing was just going to cost a fortune. So he's like, I could do just this kind of like, you know, partially animated sort of like, I can't remember what he called it, but, you know, he drew all the characters and, you know, basically like, you know, well, he did it like that. And so I was kind of like, okay, that's cool. And, you know, my whole family got aunt. So that's like my kids and my wife.
Loved it. I love it. Jason, where can people find you if they want to find your music online?
Well, you know, Spotify, Apple Music, Slim Gamble, Gambill.
That's right.
And, you know, so all the streamers, my website is slimgamble.com, YouTube, Slim Gamble, Instagram, @SlimGamble. So basically put in first name, last name, and it'll show up somewhere.
Well, Jason, I want to have you back on. Thank you for being a guest on Wake Up
Hollywood. Yeah, this has been a blast, man. Really great connecting again.
It's like, and we got to collaborate on some music. We got to make play some shows together. I just, I miss your musical vibes always. And you're just a great cat, as you always have been. And I just want to thank you for being on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Jason Slim Gamble, I still will always call you Jason.
I'll take that. That's all right.
We'll take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Real quick, last shout out. I want to make a shout out to D'Angelo. D'Angelo, rest in peace. You made some of the best music around. I know Jason was heavily influenced by it. I know I was heavily influenced by it. Voodoo is one of the best albums out there. Check it out. So rest in peace, D'Angelo. Thank you, Jason.
4 years old, man. Not that much older than us.
I know. Scary stuff.
Crazy. But
I really appreciate you being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, Jason. We'll have to do this
again. Thanks for having me, man. Yes, sir.
About 9-10 months, all right? So you get ready for that call because you were going to showcase more of your music.
I'm in, man. I'm in.
Awesome. Well, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We'll see you guys next week. Peace and love and hair grease.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.